Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron from the Heartland Institute, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and Mark Brown, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the offices of the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago on State Street at Great Street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a message, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. The audio and video portion of this program is available. So if you miss it on a Sunday night, you can find us for weeks or months, perhaps years to come at beyondthebeltway.com. Well, obviously, as you know, in Washington, D.C., against the third Sunday night in a row, where there's news maybe perhaps breaking during our program, Senate and House Republicans, Senate Democrats, as well as the White House are still trying to work out that deal. The big deadline coming up on debt ceiling is coming up on Tuesday. Both Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell were on the Sunday morning show suggesting that they thought a deal was pretty close. They were close to a deal. They were very optimistic. It was a preliminary vote this afternoon. Harry Reid, it didn't go Harry Reid's way. So the procedural motion, however, allows it to come back again. So both sides think that there's going to be a deal. And before we get into the specifics of at least what the deal of the moment is, I want to spend a few seconds or a couple of segments talking about sort of the posturing that's going on. Mark Brown making his first visit with us tonight, longtime columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Mark, you've been following politicians for most of your life. You know they're virtually always posturing. But in the game of posturing that's going on between the Republicans and the Democrats, are you able to say who's winning that posturing battle at the moment?
Well, I've been thinking about that this afternoon. I guess that the Republicans are winning in as much as they're going to come away with this with more of what they wanted than the Democrats are of what they were looking for. In the long run, you know, is that going to help them? I really believe that this whole big mess is not going to play well to anybody's advantage come election time. It's just people are just they're really fed up that this happened, and I think that's everybody's going to get punished. That's my take on it.
Bruno, you're with the Heartland Institute,
right?
More right of center than left of center.
Free market think tank.
Market think tank. But my question to you is, would you agree with Mark that right at the moment, again, first blush, it looks like the Republicans and the Tea Party element within the Republican Party may have an edge here in getting more of what they want, at least on the surface?
I'll take it a step further and say that it's actually much more than an edge. If things look the way I saw in the last iteration, it's almost a rout. Now, Mark might be right about who gets punished, but it's a rout. I mean, you're talking about no new taxes or even tax deductions. You're talking about $2.3 trillion in cuts. You're talking about cuts to Medicare and Social Security at some level that it's going to be worked out by the super Congress idea that they're talking about. Clearly, you can look in the headlines and see how negative everybody is on the Tea Party. The fact of the matter is the Tea Party at this moment in time is probably the most powerful political force in the country. They may overplay their hand, but that's where they are now.
Charles Upson, your view of the posturing battle.
I agree with both Mark and Bruno in the following sense. I think that there's a general disgust with Washington, a disgust. I think that the terms of the discussion are now on the Tea Party side, and that is not only because of the last election, it's because of the fiscal realities of a very high budget deficit that's unsustainable. And I would say the following as a reservation, namely that if there is a failure to reach a deal after all this coming close, then who wins or loses out of that failure will be a tussle, a scrum that goes on.
I want to challenge one, but you said everybody's, you know, upset. I mean, of the people within your sphere of influence, who's upset? Because some of the people that I've spoken with, many of the people I've spoken with, they're not upset. And you know why they're not upset? They're not upset because in their mind, the Tea Party people are holding the Republican establishment, their feet to the fire, and they're happy about this.
You asked
they're
me,
not upset.
Let me respond. I completely understand that, and I know lots of people like that. And I know lots of people on the left who are deeply upset that there are not tax raises that are in this. But when I said a sort of general public out there, I'm actually thinking about people my children's age who are in their late 20s. And I talked with them and asked them what was going on sort of general Twitter stuff. And they're not political, not following politics very closely. And there are a lot of people who are just upset with the process. Having said that, Bruce, I think that we are moving a car that was going forward in terms of fiscal spending into one that's going backward, and you're going to hear the gears grind.
But people, in my view, people who are upset with the process, again, this gets back to things that you've been covering for years, Mark. I mean, politics 101, you make your deal, you know, at the last minute.
Of course.
You don't make, I mean, covering Springfield in Illinois. I mean, no deals are ever done, you know, in February and January.
But this seems, has come across like a whole nother level of brinksmanship that we're not used to as a country. I mean, yeah, them playing games in Springfield about the budget, or even when they play games in Washington about whether or not they're going to shut the government down. That's you've been looking at shutting the economy down. And that's – I know that there are certainly the believers really believe that the Tea Party guys, what they've done here is good for the country. But I think in the mainstream, all that anybody's seeing is that the government, the country.
I don't think people are more disgusted, though, than they were during the lead up to the Obamacare passage, where there was pork being handed out.
I agree with that.
And one of the things that makes this hard is it's all about big policy. There's no pork. There's no committee assignments. I mean, we may learn of a little twist or turn at the very end, but boy, it's been very different from horse trading in the past.
But is it at the core of what's making this either both sides willing to compromise, and that's the word that nobody likes to talk about in Washington anymore, is setting up this 12-member commission. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the politicians covering their rear ends, kicking it down the road, setting up, by the way, which is what I suggested last week on this program, something similar to a base closing commission, so nobody's fingerprints can be on the bad news when it comes beyond the next election?
Must be your idea, Bruce. They must have been listening to the show, and that's how they came up with it.
I mean, that's the way the politicians have...
That's how they wash their hands.
...system they've devised to keep them away from political pressure when they don't have the guts to stand up and make the hard decision. I want to get everybody's reaction. 1-800-723-8289. I want to find out if you're really upset. If you are upset, who are you upset with? And your reaction to what's happening in the great debt ceiling debate in Washington, D.C. I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8289. From Allentown, Pennsylvania to Alamogordo, New Mexico, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. If you have just tuned in, some of the issues that this is the Democratic plan, that is at least it's the plan at the moment. Again, some of the broad strokes appear to have been approved by the House Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell. But again, not enough votes for everything. But some of the working issues that are on the table, this is to raise the debt ceiling in three stages, $416 billion right away, and two more times after that, up to $2.4 trillion. There are $752 billion in cuts in discretionary spending, including additional cuts and savings of about $1.4 trillion. The total cuts over 10 years, this is over 10 years, $2.2 trillion. But there are no change to major benefit programs such as Social Security and Medicare. and you've heard Republicans and Democrats and college professors for months on this program say, if you're not touching those two things, you're not being serious. So at this moment, they're not being touched. It includes $1.4 trillion in savings from winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That'll make a lot of progressives and some even moderate Republicans happy. $375 billion in savings from reduced interest. And then there's going to be further cuts from sources, a better tax enforcement, Freddie Mac cutting crop subsidies and things of that nature that, again, have some political dynamite involved with them. No new taxes. No increase in federal taxes. This will drive the progressives nuts. They want to push that discussion off to beyond the election, so perhaps it can be an issue in the presidential election, but it's not going to happen right now according to this plan. They set up, we talked about this before the break, they set up a 12-member bipartisan congressional committee to draft legislation to lower the deficit to 3% to domestic gross product, gross domestic product. That's something they want to do this year, but if they can't work out an agreement, then there's going to be an across-the-board cut, which will involve a lot of areas. There is no requirement for a separate House and Senate vote on a balanced budget amendment. Some Republicans and some Tea Party people wanted an assurance that it was going to pass. That's not going to happen. It will be called, Mitch McConnell said, Harry Reid said, it'll be called. No one is obligated to vote for it. So the idea of having an up and down vote so you as a voter can know who's for it and who's against it, it's not going to happen before you go and reelect or elect members of Congress. And one of the arguments that's come out from some Republicans, who've wanted to cut. Remember, that's all the Republicans have been talking about, cut. Well, when it became apparent that if the commission can't agree on cuts, that triggers automatic cuts. And when you get into the automatic cuts, it gets into some of the entitlement programs and it gets into the military budget. That has triggered reaction of a negative nature from the conservatives, primarily in the Republican Party, who say, don't touch the Pentagon. And so now we're hearing Republicans that wanted to cut everything. They wanted to have everything on the table. But now, don't touch the Pentagon.
You got to touch the Pentagon.
Of course you got to touch
the
Pentagon.
I mean, it's ridiculous to argue that you can't. The idea that a bureaucracy that big has no waste or no place to cut, particularly if you're winding down some wars, how much to cut? Do you want to cut into – can you find fat and cut it? Are you cutting into muscle?
The amounts are very serious. Let me just say
– $200 billion, right, out of
– No, much deeper. The trigger – we don't know what the triggers that will be negotiated are. If they turn out to be 10%, that will be a serious cut in Medicare. Progressives will be very concerned about the nature of that trigger, if that's the trigger that's in there. And the amount that would be cut out of the Pentagon would be $500 billion, maybe as high as $800 billion. And this is very serious, and people like Joe Lieberman have spoken out against that. So that the nature of the triggered cuts themselves will be negotiated, I assume. It won't just be across the board necessarily. But you've also had people who are foreign policy hawks like Charlie Krauthammer say, look, you can't govern from one house. He would be willing to accept this on the grounds that let's put it to the electorate in the Senate and presidential election next year.
Let's go to Rochester, Indiana. Ed is listening to us on WoWo out of Fort Wayne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, good afternoon or evening, whichever the case may be.
Good afternoon.
Anyway.
Well, it's good evening in Indiana.
Well, I'm angry with the president and the Democrats.
Why?
Well, the House sent up the cut, cap, and spend, or balance, and they wouldn't even look at it because they don't want to stop spending. They want more and more money, more and more money. They don't want to talk about cutting spending. And the president would say, well, you know.
Wait a minute. The Democratic plan includes $752 billion in cuts to discretionary spending. I mean, those are cuts. They talked about, you know, cutting, the military budget. And now you got Republicans complaining that they're cutting the military budget. I mean, if you want to cut, how can you cut and not touch the military budget? It's impossible.
They have to cut the military budget.
All right, well, there are a lot of Republicans this afternoon are saying they don't want to support it. So you've got some Tea Party people, you've got some conservative Republicans, and you have the head of the Progressive Caucus, Congressman from Arizona. He doesn't want to support this either. They may have to get this thing passed by not having either of the extreme elements of the party involved in both parties.
I got a suggestion. Why don't we just cut to what they call the base level 10%, and that's 3% less than what we spent last year.
Well, that's what they may get to if they can't figure it out.
Number one, there's a few big enchiladas on the table that they're not talking about yet, but I think they're starting to talk about. The fact is that you could literally change America's fiscal situation overnight if you got rid of baseline budgeting. Repeal the 70...
What is baseline budgeting?
Baseline budgeting is where you, every year, you start off with what you had. So if program A got $1 billion, the next year it's going to go up by 7% no matter what, and then anything under that 7% is considered a cut.
But it's not going to happen.
Well, it's going to. I think we're going to have to go to zero-based budgeting, and all you have to do is repeal the 1974 Budget Act. Prior to 1974, we were in better fiscal shape. Why not put that on the table?
Let's go to Nick in Normal, Illinois, listening to us on WTIM. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello. Hey, I learned something. The Baseline Budgeting Act, the 74. Today's a good day. I am disappointed. Actually, I'm very angry at Tea Partiers, and how the Republican Party has not been able to neutralize them and at least get some sort of compromise here. With the Gang of Six's legislation, that struck me as compromise. I think you had one liberal senator in there, my senator, Dick Durbin. The others were not. You had some good conservatives and some good moderates. We cut corporate tax rates, so we wouldn't have been the highest tax rate in the country. We would have, or in the world, we would have been like, maybe around 10th or 15th, and it seems like everybody gave a little something. Now, the Tea Partiers treat it like it's heresy. Frankly, I question their patriotism, that they would love the country so little that they would want us to default on our to do something unprecedented on the global gold standard for a bond. To default, that is a very unpatriotic act.
But in looking at the deal as it stands right now, I just said that, you know, the sectors of Congress that may not be supporting this compromise are some Tea Party members and some progressives. Well, if that's the case, then haven't the old graybeards, Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, haven't they been able, under the brand of compromise, the banner of compromise, haven't they potentially hammered this thing out that's going to upset everybody? And maybe the Tea Party isn't going to be viewed as the big winner here after all.
But the nature of the deal that Harry Reid has had to agree to is shaped significantly by the Tea Party influence. So I think it's wrong to start calling people unpatriotic. I'm sure that the people on both the progressive side and the Tea Party side love America. That's not the issue.
Let's go to Steve in San Francisco, listening to us on KGOE. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm upset as well with the right wing. I feel that this I don't think it's a compromise. I see it as coming mostly on the backs of the middle and the working class, and I don't think it's right. It's great there are going to be some defense budget cuts, but I think they really have to look more at increasing taxes in the form of closing all those corporate loopholes.
I feel his pain. The fact of the matter is that this is, and that's one of the reasons why I said this looks like, and you can blame the Tea Party if you're against this, but this looks like a Tea Party route. And quite frankly, what they've done, and I think with the help of the Tea Party, the Republicans, Mitch McConnell and Boehner both, in playing their games, have maneuvered Obama into a very, very negative position. You can look at it with poll numbers and everything. So as a conservative talking to a progressive caller who's mad at the Tea Party, all I can say is I really feel bad for you, but the other side won this one.
Well, I also think that, you know, if you're ticking off the progressives, it's the old thing, where do progressives go in the presidential election? There's not going to be a Democratic challenge to the president. But again, if you don't have the intensity of your base, which Obama may not have the intensity of the base, Obama doesn't make it to re-election. Back shortly from Chicago. From Menlo Park, California to March, Mississippi, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Speaking of March, Mississippi, one of their pride and joys is with us this evening. He is Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. And also joining us this evening is Bruno Barron. He is the director of the Center for School Transformation at the Heartland Institute, which is a free market think tank. And making his first appearance on our broadcast is Mark Brown, longtime columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, where he's been a reporter since 1982, writing a column for the last 11 years. And before we go back to calls, I got a little snicker from Mark during the break when I talked about whether Obama might be a one-term president. So let's spend a little time talking about the politics of the Republican Party. And is there anyone in that field, Mark, that you think is a serious contender to Obama?
Well, my snicker was about questioning the intensity of the base. And my thought on that was... The progressive base. And my thought on that is that the Republicans are going to go through a process here from what we've seen so far that will... help energize the base.
The Democratic base.
The Democratic base.
Obama can basically let anything happen, and even if progressives are ticked off, they're not going to be so ticked off that he loses an election because of that intensity. In your view,
he can't let anything happen, but he's got to keep the country from going to a default. That was our starting point in here. So he was always going to lose this thing, you know, because he wasn't going to drive the ship off the cliff. So all of his he set up one negotiating point after another, and each one of them he's had to give up. But I all of these things are ticking off the base, and I don't know how many Democrats will vote for this in the end.
I have a question for you, Mark. This is Charles Lipson, and that is: will the base be energized by anything positive in the in the presidency, or will they be energized because they really hate the Republican nominee?
Well, he's got a year to help, you know, make the case better for the positive side of things. There'll be some things.
They'll like the health care bill. Is there anything else?
I'm not even sure they're going to like the health care bill. Democratic base understands what's going to happen with the health care bill, and I still think that's a problem. But I do think that when, you know, Rick Perry tells, you know, they find out about creationism being taught in the Texas schools and, you know, things like that, that'll get them going. And Michelle Bachmann, I don't know, she seems to have a way of getting people riled up.
My question is whether they have anything that they're going to really love about this Obama presidency that's going to motivate them in a positive way, the hope and change side of it.
I don't think it's going to be hope and change because, again...
No.
But that, you see, all that positive stuff has been played already, and now he's got a four-year record he has to defend. I mean, this is today's... I took this off of today's Real Clear Politics page. Here's some of the headlines, and there's some other headlines on the other side, too, but Obama needs to dramatically change course. Watching him turn to Carter before our eyes. President shifts under pressure. Why voters tune out the Democrats, and that's by Stanley Greenberg, a Democratic pollster. Noonan wrong to call Obama a loser. Minds opening to libertarian ideas. Obama is losing a battle in which he had superior forces.
Other than that, things going well for him?
He's completely... this goes back to Hillary Clinton's most devastating ad against Barack Obama in the primary, and that's at 3 a.m., the phone is ringing. Who's answering that phone? This is a smart man who thinks he can govern like a college professor instead of a governor. And he's just – I think you're starting to see his failures here.
I'll challenge you on the 3 a.m. phone call. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. He gets a call. Kill him. It's the Obama decision. I think that answers the 3 o'clock.
I really honestly don't
over and over again.
What president
But here's a guy already. I mean, America has already forgotten this. Even the right of center people, you know, who will not give him credit for anything.
I give him credit for that.
He did get it. Well, I know you did.
I give him credit for that.
But who? Let's cut to the chase here. Okay, you're rattling all this off. Who beats him? The last time you were here, you were singing the praises of Tim Pawlenty.
I still do.
And it's a very small chorus, and because I don't hear any groundswell for Tim Pawlenty.
And you're absolutely right. And there's a whole dynamic going on with Iowa and New Hampshire, and here's the kicker. Tim Pawlenty has the lowest negatives and the highest positives. He's climbing in the polls slowly but surely in Iowa. And at the end of the day, you're going to see Perry and Romney and all these other people take each other out. You go with the guy who has the highest negative. I mean, highest positives and lowest negatives. And even there, Obama loses if unemployment is above 7 or 8%. Obama wins if unemployment is under 6, and everything in the middle is a toss-up.
And it's 9.2 right now.
All of those things are standard political analysis 101. But the question is, when it comes down to the messenger that's going to carry the message, that's just going to repeat what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that messenger yet in the Republican primary.
Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin cannot win the presidency, in my opinion.
Right.
I think that that Mitt Romney has a good shot. I think that Rick Perry would have a good shot. And I think that Mark Brown's comments about his social conservatism and so forth will hurt him. I think that it would be a close race, potentially. I think that there are other candidates, including Tim Pawlenty. And you might see pressure for somebody like Mitch Daniels to get back in because it's a very winnable race.
At this moment, it's going to be Perry, Romney, or Pawlenty, one of those three.
I think that's right.
I mean,
right.
I think Perry has a very interesting narrative. I'm just saying, as far as energizing the Democratic base, there's plenty there to energize the base. But he, you know, the whole Texas economic situation, the success there.
Four out of ten jobs in the last decade.
Let's go to Craig in Menlo Park, California, listening to us on Sirius XM Radio tonight. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good evening, Bruce. This is a pox on all of our houses. Everybody loses as a result of what's been going on. And I live and breathe politics, but the difference between this and the ordinary so-called crises like our regular shutdowns here in California is that normal people actually care about this one. My wife, who cares little about politics, came to me the other day and said, "Hey, what are you reading to keep up on the debt crisis?" I work in venture capital here in the Silicon Valley, and the potential default has actually been negatively affecting how deals are happening or not happening, and when they're happening and not happening, to fund small technology companies by investors who already have the money in the bank. It's not like they have to go out and borrow the money, but this risk has been affecting it. And because everybody is this is all anybody's talking about right now in the real world, not just within the Beltway. And I think the result of this is we're going to see a deepening of divisions among the population, a continuation of the process we've been seeing over the last few years.
Greg, let me ask you this question. This week is the second Sunday in a row where one of the lead questions, Gene Sperling was the administration mouthpiece that was on today. And the question was, how are the markets going to, the world markets, how are the world markets going to respond to what's happening literally right now today? Well, now it's later in the day. It's 8 hours, 9 hours later in the day than when that question was asked to Gene Sperling. You're a money guy. You're a money guy from California. What do you think will be the reaction of the markets tomorrow to just what's happening so far today? Are there positive signs today, or because it's not yet done, is that viewed as a negative sign?
Well, I think it's not yet a catastrophe in terms of what's going on in Washington. People haven't stormed out of the room yet. So I think people are willing to hold their breath for a little bit longer. But the longer term issue is the bigger problem. Nobody has confidence in the United States political system any longer. I talk to my partners regularly in Shanghai and Beijing and Tokyo, and they laugh at us, and that will have long-term. It's already having long-term consequences on
What do they laugh at? Can you be more specific?
Sure. The politicians cannot figure out a way to come to what should be an obvious answer, that we are spending more than we take in. The exact mix of how you fix that problem, whether it's taxes or spending cuts or some one the other or somewhere in between, is irrelevant. The fact is that for years we've been unable to actually figure out that that's a problem, and that's what they laugh at. They don't folks in Beijing don't care how we fix that. It's the fact that we've been unable to do so.
Can I ask you one question as well? Very interesting comments. When you looked at these latest GDP numbers and the downward revision of the first quarter and so forth, where we're in what looks like 1930s numbers, what do you think about that? What do your partners think about that? What do people who are launching businesses think about that? Is that short term, or is that a more structural problem?
I think it's more structural, and frankly, it's not surprising to anybody who's kind of living and breathing in the middle of it. Nobody feels good. I mean, frankly, in my group, we're having actually a pretty good summer doing deals, and so we're happy about our own little parochial world and our corner of the business. But we worry about another shoe dropping. Nobody has a lot of confidence in what comes next.
One last question. Of the things that you're aware of right now, again, this story is evolving, and some of the elements that I've just ticked off in the last couple of minutes, what is the one aspect of what you heard that is absolutely the most outrageous part of this alleged deal? I need a 10-second answer.
The possibility that we're going to do this again in a few months is the worst possible scenario.
Okay, very good. That's a good answer. 1-800-723-8029. Thanks very much, Greg, for giving us a call. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border on America's Great Talk radio stations as well as Sirius and XM Satellite Radio. I'm Bruce Dumont, live every Sunday night from Chicago. From Lisbon, Ohio to Portland, Oregon, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight, 1-800-723-8029. During the break, you wanted to talk more with our caller, Greg, from San Francisco, but he is gone.
Uh-huh.
You wanted to challenge his premise.
Well, it wasn't really so much challenging his
Bruno
premise,
Barron.
And it was a very fascinating call. Quite frankly, one response is that we've had Chinese, Japanese, Europeans, we've had people across the world talk about American decline and laugh at America for decades, and somehow we just keep on, we're like the Energizer Bunny or Bugs Bunny, we just keep on popping out on top, and I think we still have the opportunity to do that. The other point is that if this deal, as we are kind of talking about it right now, passes, I think we've at least dodged the bullet temporarily, and we live to cut and fix and work on this stuff another day. As opposed to where the caller, where Greg is going to be 100% right, is if somehow these deals that are talking about blow up in the next 2 or 3 days, they don't happen, and there is a big financial conflagration of some sort that happens market-wise, then I think he's going to be thought of as very prescient and accurate.
When you've been on this program before, you have talked about some big ideas as it relates to tax reform,
right,
and a variety of things.
I play small
nature.
Ball.
Given what we've learned during this debate,
mm-hmm,
in a very complex discussion, how realistic is it that we'll ever, I mean, at least in our lifetime, Mark, that there will be some dramatic change in the tax code is going to be ripped up and started over again? Anything of the monumental nature that may need to be done, can it be done in this climate given the experience of what we've just gone through for the last year and a half on this, and prior to that, a year and a half to 2 years on the health care bill?
I believe that the American people prefer things to just kind of move along gradually, for change to be small. And now if we had a collapse, if we had a total meltdown, then maybe emerging from that would be the sort of drastic reform that you're talking about. But I think the whole reason I think this situation here is going to get a lot of these guys in trouble is that people don't like to see the country steered off the cliff here and coming, you know, they don't want to get right up there to the edge.
Do you think Barack Obama has made the word change a bad word, Charles?
Well, he hasn't executed very effectively on the changes that he promised. So in one sense, I think, yes. I want to agree partially. I certainly agree with Mark's point that he's given social engineering a bad change. And this idea of small incremental changes as opposed to you revamp the whole medical system, I think we got a tremendous amount of feedback. And the politicians, especially the ones who were controlling both the House and the Senate and the White House, didn't listen to that. But I do think there's a chance for significant changes to the tax code, not a VAT, not a sales tax. But I think that moving back toward the Reagan-Tip O'Neill bargain where you got much simplified tax code, lowering of overall rates, broadening of the base, a lot fewer loopholes, a lot fewer a lot less room for politicians and K Street lobbyists to get together. I think there is room for that.
Well, and this is one of the reasons I give a lot of debates with folks about this, and here's one of the reasons why I'd love if that were true so you don't have to go through cataclysmic changes or the political effort necessary. The fact is that from Reagan to Clinton to Bush, the tax cuts that have been made, the tax cuts that have taken place, have taken so many middle-class people off of the income tax rolls, not the Social Security tax, but
now
the income tax rolls.
50% of the people don't pay taxes. When,
and the only way you can broaden that base to start having it produce the income necessary to pay for even a scaled-down Medicare and Social Security system, you're going to have to start reintroducing those people to the tax code, and they're not going to like it. So this whole idea, and this is where I almost outside, and I like to call myself a progressive conservative at times. The fact of the matter is, if the conservatives and Tea Party people out there think that we can rerun tax cuts and economic growth, that string is played out. We've got to cut spending. We've got to reform entitlements steeply, aggressively, and that doesn't mean throw grandma off the cliff. That means create a system that's going to be there for the future grandmas and not only pay for the existing grandmas. And the Democrats got to understand that, and the Republicans got to understand we need a new tax code. Otherwise, we're just going to try and rerun the same movie, and it's not going to work.
Yeah, but given the lessons of the last 18 months on this, I don't know how you get the attention and so that you can have the educational experience that you need so that the voter will wake up and say, listen, I'm following this discussion.
I'm a little bit of an optimist on that. I think more people are listening more closely than ever before. You've had a darn near meltdown. You've had a great recession. You've had this brinksmanship and twice this year. You've had four major shift elections. I think you're starting to see people shake loose from their old allegiances to the hard left or the hard right or the strong D or the hard R. And I think the people are actually open. What we need is a politician willing to make those cases.
I would love to know if there's anyone within the sound of my voice, wherever you may be listening to this broadcast this evening, if your political view has been altered at all in the last year and a half as watching this debate. Whether you're left and you're moving to the right, or you're right moving to the left, or you're in the center and you're stuck where you are, has anyone been moved from where they began politically in the last year and a half? And we've had a highly focused debate on this, on the debt ceiling, for the last several months, and prior to that, we talked about health care. I'd like to know if you've been politically moved one inch. 1-800-723-8289. That's what we're going to talk about in the next segment of our program. Bruno Barron from Heartland Institute has joined us. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. And columnist Mark Brown of the Chicago Sun-Times. They've been with us in hour number one. They'll all be back for hour number two. And we'll take your calls at 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back in a few minutes. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron from the Heartland Institute, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and Mark Brown, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Our program coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289 if you'd like to email us a comment. Our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, the deal is not done yet, but it's moving forward. Both sides, in the Senate at least, report that they think there may be a deal imminent. That's not likely to happen tonight, but again, the deadline for the debt ceiling is Tuesday coming up, so we have less than 48 hours. The Democrats' plan at this moment calls for the following. No new taxes, $742 billion in cuts, no change to existing benefit programs, $1.4 trillion in war savings, $375 billion from reduced interest. It sets up a 12-member bipartisan congressional committee with a triggering device that would cut the budget if they can't agree on it, and no requirement for a separate House or Senate vote on a balanced budget amendment. That's something that the Republicans wanted. Again, they will discuss it. There won't be the up and down vote, so you won't be able to look at a roll call and decide who's for it and who's against it. The commission sort of kicks the can down the field a little bit further. And in the first hour of our broadcast this evening, we talked about whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, liberal or conservative, has your political position shifted at all? Or especially if you're a moderate or if you're an independent, has your political position shifted at all just because of the discussions and the debates that have been going on? We've heard so much about everybody is outraged and irate about what's going on in Washington. Maybe that's really not true. And if there is some change in the political body politic, we'd like to know about it. Let's go around the table right now. Charles Lipson, your reaction. Do you think there's shifts going on?
I do, because I think that once every 20 years or so, we get something very big. FDR, LBJ, Ronald Reagan, these were major shifts. And I think that what's happening right now is the major shift, except it's not being led by a president. In some ways, it's a reaction against a president.
What's the shift?
The major shift is that since FDR, there's been a view that the economy would be stimulated by more spending and more centralized control in Washington, a larger federal government. And I think that what you're getting now is not just a kickback from the electorate, but the fact that the country itself has hit a kind of financial wall. And that's been two things. One is that we've got a very large deficit, and the other is that the stimulus palpably did not work.
Mark Brown of the Chicago Sun-Times, do you think there's a shift going on?
Well, I can just say, personally, I've come out of this with a better understanding of the need for the government to start cutting its spending. And, you know, I think we first started seeing that here in Illinois. And, you know, now it's playing out on a national level. But I think there's a backlash coming here when people start feeling the effects of these cuts, and then they're going to start talking about, well, why aren't we raising taxes on the corporations? Why aren't we raising taxes on the rich?
Bruno Barron of the Heartland Institute.
I'm a big proponent of the idea that there's shifts taking place in the electorate. I tend to think those shifts are not necessarily right or left as much as they are kind of a a disillusionment with the old model. We're looking at a country where the far left will just simply refuses to allow any changes to take place to 1930s ideas.
Status quo.
Status quo. And then you've got a far right that is saying, no, you can't even cut some loopholes on this, that, or the other thing because Grover Norquist is going to call it a tax increase, and therefore we can't do that. And the fact of the matter is the country can't function when those extremes are not allowing ancient models to be reformed. They have to be reformed, and I think more and more people are starting to realize that.
A good politician listens to the crowd and jumps ahead of the crowd. For those people listening around the country, Mark Brown, you've been covering, obviously, the new mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, former chief of staff for the White House, who has come on like gangbusters as the new mayor of Chicago. He is talking and sounding a lot like a Republican, talking and sounding a lot like he's heard the message from the Tea Party in his dealing with labor unions. Explain what he's doing in Chicago to those listening around the country.
Well, in the first place...
And you believe him.
Well, in the first place, he's inherited a big mess. The city of Chicago, like most state and local governments around the country, hurt terribly during this recession and kept on spending at the same levels and managed to do that through the use of one-time revenues. Things like, for those that we know this very well in Chicago, but around the country, we sold off our parking meters to a private company that gets the revenue from them for the next 99 years. Basically all of which we've already spent. So we've got, you know, to balance the budget for the last 2 years, we gave away all the money from parking for the next 100 years. So he's got a big mess. One of the first things he's done is start talking tough with the unions. And he's doing that on several levels. One place is with the school system where, you know, that's a tough fight when you take on the teachers.
He's also, again, which I think is very important for those listening around the country, because you know the name Richard M. Daley. He was mayor for 20-plus years. He's also, not necessarily by name, but he's really laid the blame at his predecessor, who was in many cases his political mentor. He's not sugarcoating where the problem was, I don't believe.
Well, he's
finessing it.
Well, he's finessing it, and he will never publicly say Rich Daley did anything wrong. He says, "Oh, I love Rich Daley. He and I are the best friends."
But,
and he won't even say that he made him. He won't use the words Daley and mistake in the same sentence. But he makes it very clear that he inherited these problems and that he. It's now his job to solve them.
And, right. And he was elected without a lot of union support, so that does give him some political flexibility.
Right. He's following through and doing what he said he was going to do, which is refreshing. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we got a full board of lights. We're going to engage the audience and find out whether or not there's been any political shifts and whether or not they agree that political shift in America change. Political change is good for the country. Back shortly. From Reading, Pennsylvania to Reading, California, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's go to KQMS, where Brian is listening to us in Reading, California tonight. Go ahead.
Well, good evening, gentlemen. It's a good afternoon here. Judging from what I'm getting from the people I'm talking with, because I deal with outside sales and insurance and stuff like that, a lot of people are hardening their positions, I mean, especially to the right. They firmly believe that the government is spending more than they should be, and if we ourselves have to live within a budget, they need to do so. They're really ticked off about Obama not producing one, or even the Senate Democrats even voting on one, let alone other issues involved. They firmly believe that, you know, if you're taking $200 billion a month in, then the highest priority goes to those who need the government's assistance already. like the payment on national debt, at least the interest on it, those on Social Security, those on disability, and then the armed forces and those veterans who are on retirement. They believe they should, those should be the first ones being paid for out the gate, period. And then everyone else, they get reduced.
Brian, one point of what allegedly has been agreed to, and again, it's not been voted on yet, is the setting up of this bipartisan congressional committee, which would draft legislation later this year to lower the deficit to 3% or less of gross domestic product. And if they can't agree on a plan, it triggers a mechanism where things are cut automatically. It sets up something similar to what's been used by the Debt Commission, where for political reasons, neither Republicans or Democrats really wanted to, they didn't want to be left holding the
bag. The base closing commission.
The base closing commission. They didn't want to be left holding the bag on a politically unpopular verdict. Do you like that idea?
I think we would probably go with that with one possible exception, and that is drop Obamacare. Get rid of it. Nobody in this area, and I'm talking about most of Northern California, are highly against it.
I think his point is a very strong one. I would venture to say that Obamacare has to go based on financial reasons. It doesn't do what it says it does. I know that, you know, there's probably some people in that room that tried to come up with a plan that would work, but Obamacare is another entitlement set to hit at 2014 that makes Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid, not only does it stick its finger in all of those things, but it dramatically increases spending yet again.
Let's go to Jerry in Bloomington, Illinois, listening to us on WRPW. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I served 6.5 years in uniform for this country, and to see this pathetic excuse for a leader that currently sits in the Oval Office and those with whom he surrounds himself leading the country, I just feel like it's spitting on my buddy's graves.
Sir, let me just stop you for a second.
Okay.
What is it about the president that, in your view, makes him pathetic?
He doesn't. He adheres to none of the values that I can see that made this country great. The values that myself and the men I served with adhered to and believed we were fighting for. And he just.
But again, I'd really like to know a little bit more about it. I mean, because. What about family values? What about the values of a man, a husband, a father? Is there nothing about his life in those roles that is a positive, uplifting value that could be admired? What's pathetic about that?
He was the only person in the Illinois legislature to vote to kill children who survived abortion on the floor of the operating room. I mean, there was nobody else but him. He even supported legislation that extreme. So he has no humanity near as I can tell. He may be a pragmatist, you know, and play the role according to whatever his objective is. But no, I think there's no good in him.
Mark Brown of the Stand the Line. Mark Brown of the Sun Times. Mark, the level of disgust and hatred for the president in some circles, and by the way, it existed for George Bush as well. Do you understand? What's your take on that? Because you've known, like myself, you've known Barack Obama for 25 years.
Well, I don't know what to, a call like that. I really don't know what, and I know there's a good 10% like that out there. But I just think some people are inclined to hate, and I think they're going to latch on to whatever they perceive and want to perceive. And I'm not here I have no way to answer somebody.
Charles,
like that.
What's your take on that?
I actually think that Jerry's call represents a very small fraction. I think most people think that Barack Obama's personal story is a very appealing one. I think that there's been two kinds of objections to him, and I think one is growing. Actually, I think both are growing. I think one is that people disagree with his policies, and I think the other is people don't think he's been very effective in executing on major issues like, will the economy grow? I mean, in other words, the president is held responsible. He was dealt a bad hand, but the question is, did he play that bad hand well or not? I actually think that all this discussion about the budget, once the budget is resolved, it's not resolved, it's a train wreck, but once it's resolved, then people will step back and say, wait a minute, this economy is not growing. Do we have a strategy to get out of it? Why is the recovery incredibly weak and people now fearing possibly a double dip? So I think that it's policy and general direction, and this is spread among people in the middle, independents, many of whom voted for him and actually want to see every president succeed.
What's your reaction to the level of that call?
Similar to my reaction to the people who hate George W. Bush with the same intensity, and quite frankly, it has gotten a little bit worse with each successive president. Maybe George H.W. Bush was such a nothing, which is what I think of him, that he didn't even engender that kind of hatred. But the fact is that the left hated George W. Bush. The right, many, many people hate Barack Obama. And I think that's what that is. It's an internalization of a very, very deep hatred, so to speak, or fear of their policies from whatever your perspective is. If you don't like military involvement, you're going to hate George Bush, and you're going to find all kinds of reasons to hate him, having to do with the way the far left puts things out, the same way that people are going to do with Barack Obama. The fact of the matter is that at any point in time, any president has it within his power to dramatically turn events in his favor. They just have so much of the bully pulpit, and they have so much power in their office, that my big beef with Obama is not a level of hatred. It's that there are times that, A, I don't think this guy knows what he's doing, and B, when he does know what he's doing, which he did get Obamacare pushed through, what he does do is just bad for the country,
yeah,
in my view.
Well, I think it was disturbing. Obviously, it's it's one thing to say that you served your country for 6 years, and again, we congratulate him for doing that, as we do frequently on calls. But to say that because of Barack Obama, and his policies or his persona, that you're spitting on the graves of people that died, I think it's like those calls that
say Bush lied, people died, or somewhere in Texas a village is missing its idiot. It's the same level.
Yeah. Right.
Let's go to Highland, Indiana. Bob is listening to us on WLS Radio. You're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
I can. You sound great.
Great. I was calling in response to your asking the question in the last year and a half, has anybody changed their views?
Right.
And my answer to that is, I have a mixed bag of an answer to that. On point with the topic of the debt ceiling,
yes.
Prior to all of this happening, I would have been a hardcore, no raising the debt ceiling under any circumstances unless it's a genuine war involving military conflict type war. Now, because of what I've learned, not so much because of the demagoguery and the speeches and the things that have been said by politicians, but because of the fact that when they did that stimulus, that was sold to us, the American people, as far as I understood it, as a one-time deal that may be brought up again later. When I found out that was built into the budget and that there was going to be a stimulus year after year after year, then I realized, oh my gosh, they have put us on a course to where this debate that we're having right now boils down to 10 years from now, are we going to have a $24 trillion debt, or are we going to have a $25 trillion debt? the fact that this debate is even going on this level scares me to death as an American for my daughter that's 15 years old right now, because we are headed the way of Greece, no matter who wins the debate.
Well, you see, the one thing I would disagree with you on, I think the debate is good because it's out in the open. It isn't the perfunctory, you know, at the end of August or mid-August every year for the last 20 years, there's been like a three-column story about the debt ceiling being raised. Now we're having a serious debate about it, whether you like it or not. To me, it's government in action. Back shortly. From Canton, Ohio to Springfield, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Charles Lipson is here. He is a longtime professor at the University of Chicago, where he's a political science professor. And you have a distinguished chair, don't you? Isn't it named after somebody?
Peter Beritsma, he was actually somebody who worked in the Chicago schools. He was a self-made guy, not a rich guy. He rose up to be a school administrator and had a long association with the university.
And when someone names a chair, does that mean that your salary is covered forever?
Normally, it means the first $2 million per year. It is covered, and then after that, you pretty much have to pay for it yourself, Bruce.
No, but seriously, how does it work? Or maybe that is seriously.
It varies from university to university. At our university, it's an honorific, and it does not really change your salary, but at some universities, it does. At different universities have different price levels for donors to name a chair after their mother or their brother. And sometimes they raise money. If Milton Friedman or somebody who's famous at the university is retiring or has recently died, money might be raised like that. And sometimes those do carry salaries with them.
Very good. Bruno Berendt also joins us. He is with the Heartland Institute. He is the director of the Center of School Transformation.
Correct.
And school reform is one of your major areas of interest.
Absolutely. There's a big march on the mall, I guess, for the next last two or three days. The Defend the Status Quo march to keep things in American education exactly the same way they are. And I'm on the other side of that equation. And I think we need to transform America's schools, where the money follows the child, to a vast new array of education services.
Now, here. Earlier in the broadcast, you were talking about the VAT tax. You were talking about tax reform. Now, school reform. School reform is an issue that I can remember being discussed for the last 25, 30 years in politics. And yet it's still just – it's inching along. There's some changes. But there's been the monumental change that you hope for hasn't happened yet.
And
the Republican Party has never really seized it as a defining issue of a presidential election.
Absolutely. One of the reasons for that is it's very difficult to be an education president. It's an absolutely ridiculous thing to say. Education policy is best handled at the state level. It is best if the federal government gets involved in it. It should be a very, very light touch, having to do with maybe some testing or.
But that's my question. Why not in red states? Why isn't this reform what Bruce says?
Look at
in
this
red
last
states?
Year. It is this last year. It has really started to happen, and you've seen it in Indiana. You've seen charter caps being raised in North Carolina. You've seen the California, a left wing state, passed a law called the Parent Trigger, where parents have the ability to trigger a failing school by petition. Huge reforms, and there's more coming. The fact of the matter is, just as with the debt, this level of spending for as little as we're getting for it in American education is unsustainable, has to stop.
Mark Brown also joins us. He is a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. He's been there since 1982, a columnist for the last 11 years, and recently or earlier in the broadcast said that maybe one of the changes that's happened sort of in his life is that there's a little more of an understanding of the how bad the financial situation is. And I want to just follow up on what Bruno's been talking about, because, again, you've been covering politics and what's happening in the city of Chicago for a long, long time now. Would you say that the transformation on the issue of either school reforms, school vouchers, charter programs, that Chicago is a city where there maybe is some movement towards that, and that our new mayor is a person that will be expanding that a little bit further? Certainly it wasn't something that the previous mayor embraced very much.
Well, they certainly, the move to the charter schools was embraced, and I believe Rahm Emanuel intends to keep going in that direction. But I think what he's biting off is he's going right at the public school system itself and trying to reform the finances, not only the finances of that, but he's going at this whole issue of monitoring the teachers, testing the teachers, evaluating the teachers. I mean, he's putting his capital in the actual system, public school system as we know it, and that's where he's trying to make his mark, I think.
Do you think, though, that with some of these issues, whether it was, you know, 20 years ago, it was welfare reform. For the last 20 years, it's been educational reform. In the last 8 months, it's been government waste and cutting the budget. I mean, just as you've explained only in your own life, I mean, do you think that the body politic is becoming more conservative, maybe more fed up? I mean, they seem to be buying into more right of center or reform movements than they appear to be buying into more left of center political movements. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. And I think part of that, comes from the recession, and our governments all got in over their heads, and people realized you got to rein it in. And in many states, the states were locked into these public employee union contracts that, where they weren't having to give up exactly the same amount as people were seeing, were losing in their private sector jobs. Mm-hmm. So, but, in the last few months, I've seen the unions, they're trying to gear up. There's going to be a big fight coming back here. And they've had a hard time articulating their position so far, but
They try. It seemed to me, at least for a while, that they were going to try to seize on what was happening in Wisconsin as sort of a rallying cry, something that they could really, gin up the crowds and the constituents, for next year. But that doesn't appear to have taken off, at least nationally, like it may have in Wisconsin.
Yes, we're getting what federalism should do. We're getting different results in different states. Wisconsin and Indiana, for example, have gone in a very different direction from Illinois, which just essentially raised taxes and hadn't cut back very, very much of anything. And so the question is, who'll win?
By the way, let me just mention that we just have this word that a deal has been reached in the debt ceiling debate. The president is going to address the nation shortly. Regardless of what station you are listening to Beyond the Beltway this evening, I'm sure your local affiliated station will be cutting away. I would suspect that maybe the president will be standing by for the top of the hour. So we may be able to continue this program to the very end. But again, a deal has been struck, so much so that the president will address the nation within the next several minutes or within the next half hour. So stay right where you are. If you're driving, keep it right where it is. And I'm sure all the stations that you're listening to this broadcast on right now will be cutting away when that time comes. In the meantime, let's go to Jim in Lakeland, Florida, standing by for the president, but listening to us on XM Satellite Radio tonight. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, I certainly enjoy listening to your voice.
Thank you.
And I'm a blind 82-year-old man, and I listen to this program every Sunday night.
Thank you.
When everybody talks about flattening out the tax code, I don't know where they're going to go to get any more money. Last year, I made less than $34,000, and I paid more taxes than General Electric, who made $12 billion. That's something that about the tax code has got to be straightened out.
I couldn't.
Bruno was
couldn't agree more. I mean, the General Electric is the new American welfare queen. You know how Ronald Reagan talked about welfare queens? This is a welfare queen company.
And he was the spokesman for General Electric.
And exactly, but it's a and now what you've got is a corporation that is able to go into various offices of Congress in K Street and say, hey, we'll build windmills if you give us this. We'll do this if you do that for us over here. They've engineered themselves into a situation where they can make $12 billion. And if you think that's strange, this criticism coming from a libertarian, conservative, Republican type, the fact is that it's an absolutely untoward result that makes Republicans, Democrats, centrists, and decent people everywhere cringe because it's just not right. They should pay taxes on what they earn the same way that somebody else pays taxes on what they earn. And what you have is you've got big government, big corporation, big union, big NGO, and they're all at the top of the heap conspiring on how to bankrupt the rest of the country while stealing its freedom. It's an atrocity.
You're hearing the voice of populism, and there's populism on both the left and the right, and I think it's strong and growing stronger.
But again, on the issue of GE, it's an easy target for
it's
both
an
the
easy
left
target, but,
and the right.
But one of the reasons they're paying low taxes is they're offsetting losses, and corporations ought to be able to offset prior losses.
Fair enough.
They should not be able to do, however, is have these huge offsets for green energy, this energy, that energy. There's too much effort at the central government level to tell us whether to drink soda or drink water.
All right, we've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029, live from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont, standing by, as is the rest of the nation, for the President of the United States. He will be coming up at some point in the not-too-distant future. But right now, we're going to break away, but we'll be back in 3 minutes. And we are back, and let's go to Bozeman, Montana, where Bill is listening to us on POTUS tonight on XM Radio. Go ahead. Are you there? I guess he's gone. Let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee, where Bonnie's listening. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Well, hi. Thank you very much for your show.
Thank you.
Do you want to know why people are angry at this president? And it seems to me that that's kind of the genre of your show right now.
Mm-hmm.
He did a ridiculously stupid thing this week by making a plan with the auto dealers to increase the miles per gallon to 50 miles per gallon, I think it was.
Yes.
54.
54 by 2025. How stupid is this? How ridiculously dumb is this? My husband and I have all owned about 13 businesses in our lives, and my husband said instantly, this guy doesn't know how to run a business. He'll never know how to run this country if that's what he thinks is going to fix it. Because in no way is that ever going to stop the people who supply us with fossil fuel from raising the gas to $6 a gallon, $10 a gallon, or $12 a gallon the minute they realize we're using less of it.
Do you think this was also an idiotic idea?
Absolutely.
I wish that the government would stop micromanaging the economy. And I believe fundamentally in a government of limited and defined powers. And I don't think that the powers are limited or well-defined right now. I know that it's under the Commerce Clause that they, in effect, say we have the right to regulate automobile mileage. But frankly, I don't understand who gave the federal government that power. I know the courts have agreed that they have it. But no, I don't agree,
Bruno,
with it.
I 100% agreement with Charles. That what we have is the things that they're supposed to get right. I mean, let's look at a securities law system where you're supposed to know whether or not the securities that the entire world is holding are going to be worthless in a week or not based on real estate prices. So you could get into derivatives or securities or those or banking. And they're failing in banking. They're failing with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're failing with regulating the things that most people might agree there should at least be some kind of oversight to make sure that the system's not collapsing.
What businesses call core competencies.
Core competencies. And but yet they're telling us how much water we can put in our toilets. They're telling us what kind of light bulbs we can buy because GE lobbied for it. They're trying to tell us all these different things about what kind of cars we have to drive. It's insane. And they're it's such an utter failure that they're destroying jobs. They're destroying they're destroying literally the way Americans look at the way their country should function.
Let's go back and take a call. Let's go to Mark listening to us in Boise, Idaho on KBOI. Go ahead, Mark.
How are you doing? It's a great show, really a great show. And I guess
thank you.
It's really sad to hear. You guys can see it, and it's very easy to figure out. We got a spending problem, and we want to just keep spending, and they hide behind this automatic 7% based budgeting. And they're going to tell us they're going to save money, and they're not really going to cut nothing out of next year. I mean, if I came to them and wanted to borrow money and was acting the way they're running the federal government, they'd tell me I was crazy.
Sure, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today.
Yeah, I just it's sad to hear the drama that goes back and forth, and sure, we want to take care of people, but we've spent ourselves into all this.
So do you want your two United States senators to vote against this compromise bill or wanted to vote against it?
Well, I don't see where they really get to the root of the issue. They talk about savings, but, okay, they're going to get out of a war. Well, that's automatic. So what program is that cutting? And they're going to save on interest, but we don't know what that's going to be because if they don't cut enough, our rating's going to change and our interest rates will change. So that's kind of a smoke and mirrors thing, it seems like to me.
Is there anyone I want to just ask you a question because I want to get a sense of who on the political horizon right now is someone that you think is likely to be able to win the presidency come next year? Is there someone you're excited about?
Well, I think Mr. Plenty is interesting. I like some of the strengths of Romney, but I feel that he's too ingrained in the whole Washington program. He's going to be more of the same. So it's hard to say. I mean, those that have a lot of experience seem to be ingrained in that whole scene, and those that are new to it, I don't think anyone wants to give him credit. And we're running with a president that had no experience. So it's kind of one of those catch-22 dilemmas.
All right, thanks for your call. Let's one last call. Dave, listening to us on WLS in Chicago. Go ahead. You've got a minute.
Oh, I got a minute. Repeal Medicare Plan D. We're so busy worrying about Obamacare and his mistakes. Let's go back and fix the mistakes that Bush, Hastert, Frist made in the last go-around. $17 trillion that is going to add to the deficits. Nobody that's a retiree now or will be a retiree could have counted on it because it only started as a benefit 30 months ago.
And here's the kicker on that because I'm split on that, but I tend to go the other way. What they ought to do instead is have Medicare Part A and Medicare Part B follow Medicare Part D's model, which is what Paul Ryan wants to do. If you're going to reform the system, here's what you don't know about Medicare Part D. It's the only government program that came in under budget by about 15 to 20% less than they projected because they interjected competition. I'm not big on new welfare programs, but if they're going to fix it, they got to go to that style of welfare program.
But again, George Bush got his fingerprints all over that.
Absolutely.
So when we're complaining about the deficit and things being run up,
Part
of the problem.
I think when we get
entitlement program,
Obamacare is much bigger.
Republican entitlement program.
And Obamacare is going to be much more
on
of a disaster.
On that note, we are out of time. That was Bruno Barron from the Heartland Institute. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago has joined us. And Mark Brown making his first appearance, longtime columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Thanks very much for being with us tonight. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago, where thanks to Dan Dorfman and Mark Licht. and Tom Veracruz for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.